Hey, Derek, how you doing today?
How you doing? I mean, how are you really doing? That's what I want to know.
I'm holding up. If you're wondering why I'm wiping my head with this washcloth, you were mentioning a second ago, I'm on day 5 of my first COVID infection, and things are going okay. You know, I'm not on a ventilator or anything, so there's that. But yeah, I've lost 5 pounds.
Yeah, it's
the modern American diet plan, apparently. And you're going to lose those 5 pounds one way or another.
You and I were joking about that. Maybe I ought to try that diet. Not really, but, you know, it's almost always effective, you know, unfortunately. You know, it kind of brings me back to when we were kids. Do you remember when we were kids and we were both such wimps when it came to getting sick? Like, ugh. I can remember Mom putting, you know, the Vicks on our throat, sock around, and the little safety pin to tie it up, and like we were just not very good patients, sick patients, and I'm not even sure we've ever really worked our way out of that.
I'm a total baby when it comes to being sick. I roll up in a ball and like just moan to myself softly until I lose consciousness, usually. Wake me up in a sweaty ball a couple days later and shower me off.
Yeah. Well, these 10 people didn't gather here today to hear about our childhood sicknesses. So, you know, let's get rocking.
Right on. Well, we've got a really exciting guest today, a good friend of mine, and I think will be a good friend of yours too, Derek, Mr. Zach Henderson. Zach, welcome to Running Into the Fog with the Johnson Brothers. How are you doing?
Good morning. Good afternoon. Doing well. Thanks for having me.
So about a year and a half ago, I was telling Derek that, boy, you know, I think we really need to start investigating the Web3 technology stack and how that has implications on intelligence and how we do what we do. And Derek said, you mean like cryptocurrencies, like Bitcoin and stuff? And I said, yeah, sort of, but more on the like the non-fungible smart contract side of things. And Derek gave me the look he often gives me when I have a harebrained idea, which is, all right, Eric, you go exploring and tell us how that goes. And, you know, if you think we still need to pursue it, you know, after a few months of study, come get back to me. And a lot of that was because of you, Zach. So I thought it'd be super fun for you and Derek to meet each other here today. And as you may hear, my voice is probably not going to last this full hour, but I'll try and make it last as much as possible. Quick note for our audience, if you are on social right now watching us, as many of you are, I see from my dashboard, please go over to openrecon.com and register to join the Zoom bridge, and you can become an interlocutor potentially in the second half. This first half we call Unthinkable, and Zach's going to tell us about himself and his background and sort of why he is who he is and what he's doing. And then we're going to cut that social stream, say goodbye to the folks on social, and we're going to have a little more intimate, unspeakable discussion in the second half. So that involves bringing on as many as 3 interlocutors from our audience, and we're accepting volunteers already. I see we've got a couple of the usual suspects out there that I'm sure will be fantastic interlocutors for you today, Zach. So with that, Derek, I'm going to do some background work here. If you wouldn't mind kicking things off with Zach, I'd really appreciate it.
That sounds great. So Zach, when I think about cryptocurrency, I am still a Luddite when it comes to really truly understanding it. And maybe that represents several of the people on our live stream today. I invested a very small amount of money in a couple of cryptos, Cardano and SHIB. And let's just say my market value is a little lower, shall we say, than my cost basis, but didn't get out over my skis too far. At the same time, you know, when I think about my own journey with Web 1, Web 2, now kind of as we're on this precipice of Web 3, you know, it's already started, of course, but you know, I'm not a technologist, and maybe that also represents others on the live stream today. So, you know, when you think about your career, Zach, starting in product management, product leadership, and kind of where that has started for you and where it's taking you today, can you describe for our guests on today's podcast, Running Into the Fog, kind of the the journey, your own journey through the fog, so to speak, of what that's been like, what you've learned, what you wish you knew then that you know now, those types of things?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the best place to start is going way back to my infancy with technology. And it started as a child. I was fortunate to get a desktop computer when I was a kid. And my grandfather, I believe, gave it as a family gift for Christmas. And my journey started with trying to figure out how it worked, tinkering with the hardware aspect of it, tinkering with the software, right-clicking, finding things and breaking things I shouldn't. And that journey led into really deciding that down a technological fundamental path, I think. And that was likely part of my personality all along. I always loved to understand why things worked and understand the world through a fundamental lens. And with technology, you have so much more control once you understand the fundamentals to instantly build, instantly create, and instantly solve problems. And that was an exciting opportunity as a kid and the world of the Wild West of Web 1, as we'll call it today. Over time, the internet started to shift. Product people that were a bit ahead of my time were seeing how to use technology, especially the internet, to solve problems, and were creating products out there and creating experiences to bring efficiency to people's lives and ultimately effectiveness in areas that were novel. And that period of time is probably where the Web 2 world, and I'll try to describe what some of these concepts are as I go along. But that was when Web 2 was really developing. And that was also when I was going to college and was really in high school and college. Some of my interests had changed from sitting in my room and building web pages to going out and meeting people and socializing in sports and other areas, of course, in my study as well, which was industrial engineering. So I didn't end up going the technical route in school. And I think this interesting paradigm shift happened in technology during that phase that I was absent from to an extent as a builder, and I was very much a consumer of that. And maybe to tie this back full circle, where Web3 really started in decentralization, cryptocurrency, Web3, all of these concepts and terms you'll start to hear how they work together. But this new paradigm shift has begun. And I got into the crypto space, I'd say mid-2010s, I think it was 2014. And it took me a while to realize that fundamental paradigm shift that was occurring. And in fact, it's taken me years until this year to really be able to see it and understand it and understand where to learn more. This is a learning experience for everyone that's in this industry right now. In fact, I think I'm going to learn stuff today just having conversations with you all. So excited about that. So I'd say fast forward mid-2010s, I was doing engineering and I'd had side businesses and real estate and healthcare IT companies. And I believe at the time I was working on a real estate software platform to help scale real estate investing in creative ways. And that's where the decentralization aspect of cryptocurrency started to. There was a day where a light bulb went off and I realized, oh, there's something fundamentally different here that's going to affect our ability to provide value. And it's truly going to enable new ways to solve problems. And I think that's where the journey began. And that's been the last 6-7 years of exploring, understanding what the fundamentals are, why those fundamentals matter. And in many ways, the conversations with Eric for a while there, almost every Friday, we would have a chat and I would share things I was learning with you. And you would also oftentimes regurgitate it back to me in a very interesting way that helped build knowledge that is not being built when you're in the vacuum, when you're in the bubble. And that idea bouncing and that discussion with you is probably what led to where we are today, because the moment you started turning POAP into an adjective and saying, that's a POAPable event, I knew you were onto something.
Nice.
That's very humbling, Zach. Thank you. And you know, that sort of is how I thought of NFTs after you explained them to me, which was, these are symbols of commitment and history And as a historian myself, how do you record people's activities and experiences and do so in a way that can't be faked? You know, they can't just sort of pad their resume that way. And that's actually an interesting question that came up the other day. I was talking with the team about how to create subject matter expert indices, and that past iterations had focused on the LinkedIn profile as the place where you'd begin that and start pulling that from. Well, what does everybody do with their LinkedIn profile? It turns out they lie like crazy. They pad it. They pad it with all sorts of crazy stuff. And the joke actually came up yesterday on a call that everybody probably has the word strategist in their LinkedIn profile somewhere because everybody's a strategist, I guess. But yeah, so the notion that authentic accounting of a person's characteristics and inventory and even just interests, hobbies, you know, experiences, et cetera, could be recorded somewhere forever, and that it was never going to be deleted or overwritten. It might be changed and updated. There might be new things that are added, or there might even be, you know, trading that takes place. That notion was completely foreign to me. And so in the last year and a half, as Zach knows, there's a ton of innovation going on there that I think will benefit from a lot in the intelligence world. Pardon me, I've got a cough. Okay. I'm going to go mute.
I'm gonna just kind of pick up on that, you know, unless you have an immediate response to what Eric was talking about, Zach. Give you a chance to react if you do.
I could go in many different rabbit holes, but I'm intrigued to know where your mind's going with it.
Well, I want to go back to these two words he put together, authentic accounting. And you're talking to a guy who, when he came out of UW-Eau Claire close to 26 or so years ago, you know, I was a finance, went to work for a money manager. You know, I operate in the world of FTs, fungible tokens. FTs allow you to go to the grocery store, and they allow you to put gas in your tank, and they allow you to go to the movies and on vacation and pay your mortgage and all the other things that are there. And then this one additional letter and word has been added to the front of that. So non-fungible tokens, the NFT part. And it makes me wonder what your opinion is, you know, when we really get after it, how do we take the presence of the word non in front of fungible to drive to that point of clarity someday? Because I'm sure I'm not the only one who's confused by how NFTs actually create value that is exchanged for something that us humans can use at the grocery store or the gas station and such, right? How do we do that in an authentic accounting manner that also acknowledges, you know, things like proof of attendance protocols and proof of, you know, commitment to certain causes and the whys and the just causes of the world and such. So I'd love to hear your reaction to that, and kind of, you know, where you see this market of NFTs and crypto used in that type of capacity really moving in the next foreseeable future.
Well, Derek, I'm going to try to break down your question a bit into some contexts, and I think that'll help guide a little bit of the discussion. First, let's start with the non-fungible and fungible model. What we're really going to see as new products are built is that terminology will get abstracted away. That terminology won't be necessary. It's important to understand fundamentally what a non-fungible token is versus a fungible token is in the context of how are they different and how are they used. And ultimately, I think that's probably the most important topic that I often get into when discussing cryptocurrency, blockchain, or otherwise, is there are fundamental benefits of blockchain. That's the centralization, decentralization aspect. And we can talk about that lever in a second. And then there's the custody or non-custody of the actual data. And then within that, you have a fungible token or a non-fungible token, which gives you different technical benefits or attributes that you can manipulate and use to enable your product. And there are pros and cons to both fungible tokens and non-fungible tokens, as the solution within a greater scheme or a greater product. And we're still understanding a lot of that. So in the context of accounting, let's take currency. That's a very easy to understand principle. And in fact, one of the best use cases and probably the most effective use case of blockchain today. Bitcoin was blockchain being used to create currency. And currency, as we all are familiar with in our daily lives, it's a fiat currency. If we have cash in our pockets or we use a credit card, all that is a ledger system. It's a ledger system to dictate values of items. It essentially allowed for trade and barter to be much more efficient. And it also allows for trust to be, it creates a trust system because individuals now trust a central authority to dictate the value of items that can be traded in and out of a single currency. So cryptocurrency, having a decentralized currency, it's still currency. I can still spend it. The primary difference is who has custody of it and who has control of it. Is it centralized or decentralized? And is it in my wallet or is it in your institution? The trust aspect today is a very, I think people don't recognize the decision around trust they make when they use products today. But it's something that we have much more control over when you have blockchain or decentralized capabilities within your product. So you can give the consumer the decision of whether to trust or not. Is this something you should grant trust or not? If I were to look at your books, right? If I were to say I trust your accountants and I look at your books and or I don't even have to look at your books because I trust them, that doesn't mean the books weren't cooked. But if I create a trustless system that prevents the books from getting cooked, then there isn't a need for that trust there either. So it takes trust is a very important aspect of this, and using the new technologies to create trustless systems, I think is something that is pushing the industry forward. I think people are starting to realize that there is a lot of trust in systems and products and in centralized control and trust and authority that isn't always acted upon as they would expect when the rubber meets the road. And this paradigm shift is changing that.
Got it. Let's go back to our example.
No, go ahead, Derek.
Let's go back to his example of building the subject matter expert indexing environment, right? And the idea that if we were to benchmark for subject matter expertise off of LinkedIn, we might get a lot of inflation, elevated viewpoints of oneself to be seen in a much stronger position as a knowledgeable source and those types of things. How would you say that relates to Eric's example? If you're creating a trustless system with a subject matter expert indexing environment, where do you see that particularly overlapping with the world of intelligence, strategic market and competitive? You have any thoughts on that?
That's a great one. Yeah, let's concretize this a little bit. And I'm gonna bring into focus, I think, the opposite side of the coin, where you might see inflation in someone's resume or LinkedIn profile or their belief of their knowledge and capability. I've often worked with individuals who I've found to be the most capable, most intelligent, most successful that are incredibly modest, and they undervalue and underappreciate and then underarticulate their capabilities. And so I wouldn't want to trust that either. The trust but verify idea is really inefficient. Why should I trust but verify if I can just verify or if I can just trust? And I think with NFTs, we'll take a really good example of using NFTs here to show how this changes. The QR code on the screen here is for a POAP, and that stands for Proof of Attendance Protocol. If I scan that, I receive an NFT into my wallet that stipulates I was here, that proves that I was here. And that is held by me in my own decentralized wallet. So I have custody of that. No one else has custody of that, and it's decentralized. So in the future, if I were to ever need to prove that I was here, I could essentially authenticate with my wallet and prove that. And so let's extend that a little bit. There's a great organization called GitPoApp, who's built an integration with GitHub and projects on GitHub now that enable this. When changes are made to the repository, you can automatically mint a Git POAP that represents the stake you have in that project, the effort you put in. So what would it look like in the future to hire a developer? Would I rather see their resume or their LinkedIn or something else that someone else might have said about them? Or would I rather just look at their wallet? If I look at their wallet, I can immediately see the code they have submitted on GitHub. I can look at how they wrote their code. I can look at the robustness of it. I can ask them specific questions around why they did it the way they did it. Would that be a better representation of who they are? I think it is. Are they in complete control and have complete custody over that? No one else can manipulate it? Yes. Is that better than what we have today for both sides of that equation? I believe so.
Very interesting.
I was going in a different direction with it, Derek, but what Zach just described there is taking control back from the middleman in all things and really putting counterparties to any contract in true control of their side of the contract. And so I find smart contracts, you know, to be a fascinating innovation that takes human frailty out of governance pretty much entirely. I'm sure that human frailties can be seen in how smart contracts are designed, perhaps. And so it sort of has a vestigial nature there. But talk to us a little bit while we've got 5 minutes here before we start getting interlocutors. And Terry Thiel, I think you're number one for Unspeakable here in the second half. Talk to us for the last 5 minutes here about smart contracts and how smart contracts really remove human frailty from governance of institutions, issues, you know, transactions.
Well, you know, there are a lot of transactions that happen every day that rely on subjective contracts. And those are less obvious of how they may be improved. But I think there are plenty that occur with objective contracts that we're still manually executing. And that's really where the value comes, is what manual execution of the existing contract is taking place that must remain. And are we able to codify all of the human activity that's happening within these existing contracts? You'll start to see smart contracts leveraged probably most in the higher value industries, at least in, I'm thinking you'll see it in real estate. You'll see some of the existing transaction models where there's a lot of slack or waste. We'll have, and because of that, a lot of money is made by all of the middle parties in that. You'll see that start to change quite a bit from smart contract. But again, one of the benefits to smart contracts is I can open that contract and I can read it. And there are companies that are focused on how do I create UI that allows someone without a coding background to visualize and read this so that they can trust it as well. And smart contracts are very transparent. They're exposed. So others can, they are not above reproach. They can be reviewed. They can be vetted. They can be audited. And those that are using it, because it is not a centrally controlled entity, oftentimes you have a lot of white hat protection in the world of Web3, because the users of a smart contract tool want to see it succeed. So if they see frailties, they're going to jump in and help. It's not an attack vector now. It's a defense vector almost for the user. So it creates a nice flywheel effect. So there are a lot of benefits to that smart contract and at work.
We got a couple minutes here until I think we invite Terry on as our first one. What else would you like our listeners, Zach, to know about the world of Web3 before we go into some questions? And, you know, I guess I'm wondering, you know, at the pace of change, how fast, you know, I'm not quite 50, how fast will we move through Web3 to get to Web4 and 5? And like, where does it end? Is it even possible to forecast where the different variations of the web concepts end, you know, at least within our lifetime?
It's a really interesting question. And in 2 minutes, I'll try to keep it high level. I think we are still within the technological revolution. And this is just one of those early baby steps, no different than the agricultural revolution affected humanity in great, great ways. The industrial revolution as well. I think we're just in the fledgling stages of this technological revolution. And we've had a few quick iterations. Web one was a very much a decentralized internet. Web two was just the exploitation of that. Web three is being enabled due to the spread of technology, both hardware and software, which was enabled by Web two central actors that profited by disseminating and spreading that technology. Now that the world has the technology, the rules can change a little bit. And I think it might be very similar to living through the Industrial Revolution. What was it like when just a few people had cars? And then how did the world change when everyone had them? So the rules of the game start to change. And I think right now you can either play the rules, play by the rules, or you can be setting the rules. And those working in Web3 are very much the ones creating the game right now.
That's really interesting. Actually, last week, we go back to the book and the way in which Eric and I are working on the missionary and the mercenary, we ended up talking about the advent of car loans. And, you know, I think it was 1919 or so in General Motors Acceptance Corporation, if I have that right, it's around the late 19 teens, they came about, and it made it possible for somebody that didn't have hard, you know, fungible fiat currency in their hand to acquire a vehicle. And that sort of changed the landscape for how, you know, vehicles could be acquired and who was going to be capable of having a vehicle and all this other stuff, of which our first interlocutor today is, I'm never going to be at his level, you know, talking about the Industrial Revolution and all that kind of came along with it. So Terry, maybe that's a good segue over to you. Eric, anything to do before we move on to that?
I'm just going to get out of here.